Iowa companies and organizations have signed cooperative trade agreements with their counterparts from Hebei Province in China, worth an estimated $1 billion. This hour, Governor Branstad tells us about it. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. I'll talk with Governor Branstad to start this Friday News Buzz edition of our program. Then off to other news, including Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Bill Northey with an update on the harvest, Des Moines Register investigation showing that out-of-state motorists are far more likely than Iowans to be pulled over by state troopers. The Iowa caucuses, warts and all, star in a new documentary film. News Buzz starts right after this news from NPR. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a Friday News Buzz edition of our program, a chance for us to chat briefly about some news items we didn't get to earlier on our talk shows during the week. Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk with about a Des Moines Register investigation showing that out-of-state motorists are far more likely than Iowans to be pulled over by state troopers. We'll talk with the Attorney General's office about some scams targeting Iowans, how to beware of those. And the Iowa caucuses, warts and all, that's a star, the Iowa caucuses, of a new documentary film toward the end of the program. But first, Iowa's special relationship with China. China is one of Iowa's largest trading partners. Last year, our state exported $751 million worth of products to that growing nation: machinery, vehicles, processed meat, cereal, animal feed. This week, more good news. We heard that Iowa companies and organizations have signed 20 cooperative trade agreements with counterparts from the Chinese province of Hebei. It solidifies a 30-year sister city relationship between Iowa and that Chinese province. Joining us briefly to talk about it, Iowa Governor Terry Branstad. Governor Branstad, welcome back to our program.
Well, it's great to be back. And yeah, this is an exciting relationship we've had. I was governor 30 years ago when we signed the sister state with Hebei province of China. Zhang Shuguang was the governor of Hebei. He invited my wife and I to lead a delegation there in 84. We did. And then in 85, a young man from Hebei province who was a local party leader at the county level named Xi Jinping led a small agriculture delegation to Iowa. And, of course, Xi Jinping is now the president of all of China. And we just celebrated the 30th anniversary of the sister state with Hebei, including a letter from President Xi that the party secretary from Hebei delivered to our special 30th anniversary event in Des Moines.
Tell us a little bit about what went on this week during that signing, that celebration Tuesday night. I understand nearly 200 Chinese delegates coming to Iowa.
That's correct. We had about 200 delegates from Hebei. They also visited Muscatine, of course. Sarah Landy was chair of the Sister States Committee, and of course, they also hosted then Vice President Xi Jinping at their residence for a reunion meeting on the 15th of February last year. So they visited Muscatine and Des Moines. We had a big banquet at the Borlaug World Food Prize Hall of Fame, and a wonderful event that was hosted by Principal Financial Group. And as you mentioned, there were 20 different agreements signed, over $1 billion worth of business between us and China. So what we started 30 years ago has really grown, and they've become trusted friends. And we now are seeing the benefits of this long-term friendly relationship and all the exchanges we've had, and not just economic, but in education and culture and in sports and in medicine as well.
You said these agreements totaling over $1 billion, estimated over $1 billion. Now, I mentioned at the outset that last year Iowa had over $750 million worth of Iowa products being sold to China. So can we, with this number, this over $1 billion, sort of, can you forecast that for us into the future? How that $750 million worth of Iowa products going to China will grow, in what fashion, how fast?
Well, for one thing, China now imports more soybeans than all the rest of the countries in the world combined. Iowa is the leading producer of soybeans. You look at the price of soybeans today and why it's so much better than it's historically been, it's the Chinese demand. We also just recently had Smithfield Foods, a major pork processor, purchased by a Chinese company. They want a reliable, quality source of pork. I think it's also going to be very beneficial to the price of pork in the state of Iowa and to more pork processing in our state. They also are purchasing more corn, and now they're looking at making other investments, working with companies like Pioneer and Highline and John Deere and Vermeer, and also Principal Financial Group is working to get into the Chinese market to sell their 401ks. That could be a huge opportunity for Principal. They're very excited about it, and we think they're very close to seeing that happen.
Right, and you mentioned Principal and all the other products and services that can be sold to China's growing middle class. We find it, I'm sure all of us find it's hard to just grasp how large China is, how large this growing middle class is. How do you think about that?
Well, having gone there in 84, when most of the people were on bicycles and there were no buildings more than six stories tall, and then going back to the last few years, seeing huge skyscrapers, bullet trains, all the automobiles, China has just been transformed. They've had a growing economy over the last several decades, and the result is you do have a growing middle class. There is 1.3 billion people, and as one of the Chinese students told me at a meeting we had in my office this week, since I'm an old friend of the president of China, I have 1.3 billion friends in China. I'm just absolutely amazed how well we are liked in China because Iowans treated Xi Jinping with such respect and dignity when he came here in 1985. And the Chinese just recently purchased the home that he stayed at in Muscatine with the Dvorak family when he was here in 85.
Mm-hmm. Undoubtedly a time of great celebration as you elucidate all the great things coming our way in this relationship with China. Do you have any concerns, any worries connected with this business?
Well, obviously, China is a growing world power, and our national interests and their national interests, I think, sometimes are at odds, but we need to look at ways that we can build more friendship and partnership with them, and the unique relationship that Iowa has with Hebei, I think, can be instrumental in helping improve the relations between our two countries, and so I'm very optimistic. I've seen the changes that have occurred over the last 30 years. I think it's very positive. They've moved to a more of a market-driven economy. They have a growing middle class. They have a desire for more protein in their diet. These are all positive things that I think are going to benefit Iowa as we work as friends and trading partners with them.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense of, even though China's economy, its way of business has changed much over the last 20 years. Can you give us a sense of business leaders in Iowa who have never worked with China, how business is different? What would a business person have their eyes open to going to China and say, oh, that's different about
well,
business deals?
You got to remember, you know, China is still a communist country. They are a one-party system. And so the government has a significant role. And you have to work through, we work with the Ministry of Agriculture and work through the different areas and in order to work with, and a lot of the businesses in China also have a close relationship. But the benefit of the fact that the president of China came to Iowa first and has such good feelings about the people of Iowa and the friendship and the hospitality and how well he was treated, that gives Iowa a leg up. So the business people and the people in China who are intrigued by the wonderful feelings their president has about our state gives Iowa an advantage over other American states when it comes to doing business in China.
Governor Terry Branstad, I want to thank you for taking a few moments for joining us live here on River to River.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, a news buzz edition on this Friday. We try to catch up with news that's been happening this week that we didn't get a chance to chat about earlier in the week. On Tuesday, a Polk County judge ordered an Arizona-based telemarketing company to stop making sales calls to Iowans. In a lawsuit, Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller argued that these calls were falsely claiming to be supporting handicapped veterans and disabled workers through their sales of trash bags and other items. Along with the phone scam came the Attorney General's office, has also been busy with a big case related to buying clubs. Two companies affiliated with JCPenney have been ordered to pay more than $2.7 million to Iowans. Customers were enrolled in buying club memberships without their knowledge and charged membership fees. Here to talk about these cases, Jeff Greenwood, Communications Director for the Iowa Attorney General, Tom Miller. Jeff Greenwood, welcome to our program. Jeff Greenwood, are you there?
How are you, Ben?
Hey, I'm fine. We got you on the line. So tell us about this Arizona-based telemarketing company. We have a little bit of audio. Before you do, let's just listen to a little bit of the sales recording pitch that mostly older Iowans would have been subjected to. Let's have a listen.
It has become that time of the year where we make our calls out for support, and we're calling this year. We're begging. I don't have to tell you how bad things are in the country. But on behalf of the disabled workers, anything small goes a very long way.
Okay, can I first ask, what is your name?
Darnetta Mims.
Okay, Darnetta. And where are you guys located?
In Phoenix, Arizona.
Okay, a little excerpt there. Jeff Greenwood, tell us a little bit more about what's going on with these pitches.
Well, I'll tell you what. First of all, thanks for having me on here. That clip that you used is a case in point of a phenomenally successful undercover phone line we've had here at the office. You're hearing a firsthand account of the pitches that these folks make. These are pitches mostly to older Iowans, and we record these on an undercover line. And what has happened is there have been some older Iowans whose families have taken over their finances, or in other situations, they died. And the phone numbers, the families allow the phone numbers to transfer over to our office. So we have somebody here in the office who is answering the phone and will assume the name of whoever the target was. And it's all on tape. And it's been very, very helpful to tell a judge, look, this may be what they're saying they're doing, but this is actually what they're doing, and this is the audio that's indisputable about these sales pitches.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a sales pitch that involved calling a woman repeatedly, every few weeks or every few months, and they sell these fairly inexpensive items like trash bags or light bulbs, and they charge a lot of money for them, and they tell the recipient of the call that this is going to help somebody. This is going to help a disabled person or a veteran, and what it's really doing is it's just helping the company that's marketing these calls to Iowa. And so we went to a judge, and we said, Judge, listen to this. This is what's going on. We're asking you to stop it. And the judge issued an order stopping the company from doing this anymore.
Did any of this money go to help veterans, disabled workers?
Well, we have, in one case, we've got a call where the caller claims that he's a handicapped veteran of the Vietnam War. And after we sent some requests out to the company, we found out that that person was born in 1980, so probably didn't serve in the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about the other thing that I mentioned, these buying club offers. What is that about? What is that scam?
Yeah, we've had several different buying club cases lately, some pretty significant buying club cases. And when we say buying club, we mean when you're on the phone with a credit card company, for example, and you finish your transaction, they may say, hold on just a minute, and somebody else may get on the line and pitch to you a free offer. It's a trial offer. It's not going to cost you anything. It will enable you to get discounts or some sort of gift. And what happens is you, to get them off the phone or in a weak moment, you say, okay, but I'm not really interested in it, but okay. And after that period expires, now you're starting to get charges on your credit card bill. And these are often small charges. They're perhaps under $10 a month.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Hoping you won't notice it or what?
Well, absolutely hoping you won't notice it. And in fact, unfortunately, most people don't notice it. People don't check their credit card bills, or they may be confused. Maybe some company they don't recognize or some club that they don't recall what it was, and they just see this charge on there or they don't see it. And Iowans, time after time after time, are paying these monthly fees and don't realize it. And that's what buying clubs are.
Okay, so what can be done about that before we have to go in a minute or so? What tips can you give us, Jeff Green?
What's most important is to check your credit card bill. Check your credit card bill every month. Check your bank statements, your credit card bill, and that's how you will see that it's on there. And if you do see a charge on there, dispute it. And if you do hear of a free offer, just say no, unless you are really, really wanting that offer. You know what it is. You know what it entails. Just say no.
Mm-hmm. Now, our do not call list, you can get yourself on a do not call list. Why doesn't that prevent these people?
Because in these situations, you're already on the phone with someone making a transaction. You're on the phone with your credit card company, or you're on the phone with a retailer, and they hand you over to someone. So you're already in the door. This isn't a cold call.
I see.
There may be some situations where you get a mailing and you get a free check in the mail, and when you cash that check, then suddenly you are enrolled. So this is a little bit different than the cold calls that are impacted by the Do Not Call list.
Jeff Greenwood, Communications Director for Iowa Attorney General Tom Miller. Thank you for joining us this half hour.
Thanks for having us.
A News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Finally, in this half hour before we take a short break, according to data obtained under open records laws by the Des Moines Register Reader's Watchdog, out-of-state motorists are far more likely than Iowans to be pulled over by state troopers. This was a review of about 22,000 traffic warnings and citations issued by two state patrol crime interdiction teams from 2008 all the way to last year, showing 86% went to out-of-state motorists. Joining me now to talk about this, Lee Rude, the Des Moines Register Reader's Watchdog column writer. Lee, hello to you.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. This is very interesting. What are these interdiction teams?
The teams are special teams that are more highly trained than regular state troopers to go out and help with investigations and uncover criminal activity, not just drug activity, but all sorts of criminal activity.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the column that you wrote, and I believe this appeared last weekend, last Sunday in the in the Des Moines Register, you have an audio clip, a video clip, actually. We'll hear a little bit of audio from the clip you have of, it's actually a trooper's car, the video and audio from that of a questioning of a man from Wisconsin named Frank Ferrillo, pulled over for doing 74 in a 70-mile-per-hour zone, 4 miles over the speed limit. Before we hear the clip, anything else to say about it?
No, except that, you know, it's a 60-year-old guy. He's just coming home from a trip. He's looking into some of his family's history. He's very into genealogy, and he's coming just through Iowa on his way back from Parsons, Kansas, to Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. And this is 30 seconds of a 12-minute conversation he had with Iowa troopers in that car. Let's listen to a little bit of Frank Ferrillo with an Iowa State trooper.
So other than Myron, did you see anybody else?
No.
No?
I'm curious why you're asking those questions.
Well, gas is almost $4 a gallon, so I'm guessing you spent at least $400 or $500 in gas than you spent.
Certainly not.
No?
Oh, no.
What'd you spend in gas?
God, that's 38 to fill up, 40 to fill up, 45. I fill up 4 or 5 times. I do this a lot.
Yeah.
It's hard to get a sense of what's happening there in that 30-second clip, Lee Rude, but tell us how this conversation strikes you. How would you characterize it?
Well, you know, it's funny because it starts out simply enough, but the questions get more and more detailed. You know, at different points, there's a trooper in the car, and then there's another one in the back seat who's in training, and he's asking him everything from, you know, where he was going, what he was going, who he was talking to, what he has in the suitcases that he brought with him, you know, how much he spent. And so by the end of the video, you can tell that Mr. Ferrillo is pretty exasperated by the whole thing. And mind you, this is something for which he got a warning. He didn't even get a citation.
Right, right. And so I think to get a real sense of it, you have to go to the Des Moines Register website to watch that video, because I found it surprising. What do you think this conversation?
Well, I think, you know, what the troopers told me when I interviewed the attorney for the Iowa State Patrol, other folks with the State Patrol, they said, you know, people's states of origin are not the only factor in pullovers, obviously, but they're having to do more questioning so that they don't oversee some larger criminal activity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of the reality in the post 9/11 world.
Right. You mentioned in your article that the questioning of motorists searching their vehicles has spawned some legal challenges in recent years. What can you tell us about those?
Well, in some cases, the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, have found that some of the questioning and seizures have been unconstitutional, and in those cases, those were mostly criminal cases. The decisions have wound up being overturned.
Mm-hmm. What has been the reaction of the state and the Iowa State Patrol, I guess, in particular?
Well, they knew that this was coming. I talked to them beforehand. I haven't talked to them since, but we're actually working on a follow-up story to run before Thanksgiving at some point, where we're going to look more closely at where some of these stops are taking place and what for.
Mm-hmm. Is this so different than what other states are doing, do you think?
Well, that's hard to determine. I mean, we would like to do that, but it would sort of be like comparing apples and oranges. We had a specific database that we requested, and as far as I know, similar data is not readily available from surrounding states.
Mm-hmm. What have you had in terms of reaction? This has been almost out almost a week in reaction to this from readers of the Des Moines Register.
Well, you know, the key finding was that 86% of people who are being pulled over are from out of state. And most of the people other than Iowans who are receiving citations and warnings are from Illinois, California, and Colorado. At least from what I can gauge on our Facebook page and the comments that I've received on the phone and in email, or, you know, it's outrage. People do not like to be questioned so vigorously for such minor traffic offenses. I haven't heard very many comments at all from people who are supportive of this kind of lengthy questioning.
Mm-hmm.
It was our number one story by far over the weekend, and continued on into Monday. It clearly struck a nerve. So,
Lee Rood, thank you very much for talking with us. We'll look forward to that follow-up column. Des Moines Register's Reader's Watchdog column writer, Lee Rood, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Coming up in just a moment, we'll talk with Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Bill Northey. Give us an update on the harvest. Also, his thoughts on the future of the farm bill, if there's any movement on that in Washington, in Congress. The Iowa caucuses, warts and all, a star of a new documentary film. We'll talk about that. And new research suggesting that eating a nice warm bowl of soup can help you maintain a healthy weight. That's all coming on this NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. We'll be right back. More of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And Monday on this program, we can look forward to welcoming back Dr. Eric Dykin, our sleep doctor, to this program. So on the weekend, be thinking of your questions about sleeping or getting better sleep or some of the problems you've been having during sleep. Monday, it's a sleep doctor edition of our program. Today, News Buzz, a chance for us to chat briefly about some news items we didn't get to earlier this week. Coming up in just a few minutes, new research showing that from Iowa State University suggesting that, you know, a nice warm bowl of soup is better for more than just warding off a cold. It actually can help you maintain a healthy weight, according to this new research. And we'll talk about that with one of the ISU researchers in just a moment. Also, the Iowa caucuses, warts and all, starring in a new documentary film. But first, the growing season of Iowa farmers got off to a bit of a tough start. Remember that very wet spring we had? Some farmers were not able to plant at all, but now it's time for the harvest. The weather's been relatively favorable. Joining us now to talk about this a bit is Bill Northey, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture. Welcome.
Good to be on with you, Ben.
Tell us, what does it look like at harvest time? How much is in from the fields, corn and beans?
Well, as of Monday, the last good set of numbers we had about 70% of the soybeans harvested and 25% of the corn was harvested. So I know we've made some progress since then, so we're above those numbers. I don't know if we'd be getting around half the corn harvested, still probably 20% of the beans that are left in the field, but a lot of progress going on this week.
Mm-hmm. For us non-farmers, tell us, what determines when you harvest corn or beans, and why does it take place over such a spread out over many weeks in Iowa?
Well, it does depend on the moisture of the crop, and so the crop needs to be finished. And as you said, we had a delayed spring this year, so some of the crop didn't get in the ground when it normally did, and it still takes about the same amount of time to mature. And so that means it was going to mature later in the fall than what normally is done. We usually start soybean harvest third or fourth week of September, continue into the first week of October. Corn harvest will overlap that sometimes, maybe the end of September all the way through the end of October. Corn and soybeans have different varieties or hybrids. So some varieties take more sunlight to be able to get done, some soybean varieties. So they will mature faster, be ready. They need to dry down. We like to harvest our soybeans at 10 to 14% moisture. So they need to dry down, and those early beans will dry down faster. The later beans will dry down later than that, which is a nice thing because you want to spread harvest out. You can't harvest all in one day anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And then the same with corn. You have early corn and later corn that takes more time to mature. We'd like to harvest that corn somewhere between 15% and maybe 22%. We need to dry it down to about 15% to make sure that it'll store, and that's what we sell our corn at. That's what the elevator's stored at, and so we'd like to get it as close to that as we can so we have less drying costs to be able to get it down to that marketable moisture.
Has this cold snap in recent days affected any of the factors you just mentioning, moisture and otherwise?
You know, a little bit probably for some of the soybeans that were planted really late. So we had some soybeans that were planted on time, and then some that were planted a little late. Those probably matured normally. But then we had some that went into some of the areas that maybe even the end of June, first part of July. Some of those maybe were kind of mature but not quite mature, and so they were still stems were damp, or and you go ahead and freeze them, that'll actually cause them to finish up and dry down just a little faster. Other than that, not very much. And the corn, not so much either. That was all pretty much mature. Maybe some stalks here and there that had some greenness to them that combine even a little bit better after they've had a frost. But for the most part, it doesn't affect it very much.
Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Bill Northey, you have a farm in the Spirit Lake area, right?
I do, and I'm on it. In fact, I'm in a combine right now.
Are you working on the harvest right now?
I am. I got a day here and going to work through the weekend, and so I'm harvesting corn. I still have some soybeans to harvest as well. I got wet. Soybeans are a little fussier. You take the whole plant into the combine, and the beans themselves can get moisture in them real easily. So you've got to have the right kind of weather. I'm hoping to be able to switch back and finish up those beans here over the weekend. But the corn is I'm getting through right now, and it's going pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the harvester you're riding in right now.
I have a Case IH combine that is it's about 10-year-old combine. It's got 6 rows that it takes. These rows are 30 inches apart. It'll combine on a good day, if I've got somebody hauling probably 60 acres of corn in a day. I have 600 acres of corn and soybeans, so 300 acres of corn and 300 acres of soybeans up here. Mm-hmm. That I pretty much farm mostly on weekends, a few weekdays that I get off as well, a few days this week and maybe a day next week that I've been able to get off during the week, but otherwise mostly on weekends.
Are you able to multitask at all in your combine there, going down those very long rows, doing some of your work?
You know, I do a little bit. You try and divide that task because you do need to stay on the row. You need to watch for rocks or something else in the combine. So while I'm combining, I'm trying to combine. I may be talking on the phone to somebody, but I usually wait to the end until I read emails.
Okay. Well, let's talk before we go and get your concentration really back on those rows completely. Every year we talk about how Congress is delayed on their discussion about the Farm Bill. This year seems to be more attention to it. What's the status right now? The last Farm Bill expired on the 1st of October, right?
It did. My understanding is they've scheduled a conference committee to try and figure out how to get in a compromise between the House passed Farm Bills. They actually passed two of them, different parts of a traditional Farm Bill, and the Senate passed Farm Bill, which is more like traditional Farm Bills. That conference committee is supposed to meet next Wednesday, so fully 30 days after this last one ran out. For the most part, there's some impact because some pieces are not funded, some pieces of conservation programs, some other things are not funded. There'd be even more impact if we got to the end of the year and didn't get things funded. That's when we start to hit a year ago we talked about a milk cliff and go back into some old legislation that would require higher prices for some of the ag commodities. But it's time to get it done. This is a Farm Bill that it was already extended a year ago. For us to be at this point and not have a Farm Bill is something that everybody's very tired of.
What are you hearing as far as the biggest hurdles to overcome in Washington? This is a real lot of partisan differences here, aren't there?
Yeah, there are, and more than normal. You know, often it's been where there's been some differences between the farm community and the non-ag community, although it was bipartisan within both those groups. Right now there is some partisanness, and certainly between the House and the Senate, primarily around the funding for the food stamp program, the SNAP program. There are some other differences out there that are a little more hard to explain, and it's hard to know until they get some of the numbers settled on the food stamp program, what those numbers are. But right now, that's a big part of the difference, the funding level for that. One looks at cutting the food stamp program. The House bill was for a $4 billion a year cut, $40 billion over the next 10 years on the $80 billion food stamp program. The Senate looked at $500 million a year, or about $4 or $5 billion over the 10-year program. It doesn't seem like a lot of difference. I mean, that sounds like lots of dollars, but when you cut it down per year and you compare it to an $80 billion program, it would seem like there's a way to come together if there was really the will to make that happen. And hopefully there is now. We'll see.
Okay, we'll leave you to more harvesting. Bill Northey joining us actually from his combine in Northwest Iowa, Secretary of Agriculture. Thank you for taking time out for us.
Thank you, Ben. Great to be with you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer.
Just follow the ordering procedure and you will be fine.
It's very important not to embellish on your order. No extraneous comments. No questions.
Medium turkey chili. I didn't get any bread.
Just forget it. Let it go.
Excuse me. I think you forgot my bread.
No soup for you.
Last night, my wife made delicious homemade black bean soup. And I didn't have to put up with any of that. With the chill of autumn setting in, soup sounds so good. And we all know about turning to a piping hot bowl of soup to fight off the cold. But a new study led by an Iowa State University researcher raises the possibility that eating soup more frequently may reduce the likelihood of overeating. James Hollis is an assistant professor of food science and human nutrition at Iowa State University. He's also the lead author of a paper published recently in the journal PLOS One. James Hollis joins us now. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here.
You and your co-author, Yong Zhu, a postdoctoral researcher and epidemiologist at the University of Iowa, conducted this study. Your paper says Americans who eat soup are less likely to be overweight. Explain.
That's correct. So we used data from the NAINS study, which is a cross-sectional survey designed to assess the health and nutritional status of residents in the United States. And when we looked at this data, what we found was that people who consumed soup were at lower risk of being overweight and obese than people who didn't consume soup. In addition, the people who did consume soup, the frequency of soup consumption was also related to the risk, to body weight and BMI.
Mm-hmm. Did you establish any reason for this, any causal relationship?
There isn't, and that's one of the problems with this type of study, is it can't show a cause and effect relationship, of course. However, we find soup quite a fascinating substance because it's a liquid food, but yet seems to have a satiety, provide a satiety response that most liquid foods don't. We've done some previous work in my laboratory looking at the satiating properties of soup, and it does seem to be that possibly one reason that it does contribute to lower weight is that it's quite a highly satiating food.
Mm-hmm. Of course, there are all different types of soup. When you say liquid, we can go very liquidy, but also way up to, I mean, is a nice thick chili in the category of soup. I guess, broadly speaking, it is, isn't it?
Yes, although definitions are always hard to come at these foods to determine what is a soup or not. Again, some of the previous work that I've done in the lab does show that there's differences between soups. Mm-hmm. That if you have a thin broth type soup, it's maybe not as satiating as something that contains large pieces of vegetable or meat, which requires mastication and other things. However, still with the thin broth, it does provide a satiety response.
Mm-hmm. Mastication, in other words, chewing, right?
That's right.
Okay. Did you look at any other things having to do with soup in this study?
Yeah, we also looked at the effect on the metabolic syndrome, which is like a collection of risk factors for chronic disease. But we didn't find any relationship between soup consumption and risk of developing metabolic syndrome. However, we did find that people who didn't consume soup had a lower level of HDL cholesterol, which is the good cholesterol. And they, people who didn't consume soup also had an elevated waist circumference, which is, again, a risk factor to chronic disease.
What is metabolic syndrome?
So metabolic syndrome is a collection of sort of risk factors for disease, such as elevated BMI, elevated triglycerides, elevated waist circumference, and reduced HDL cholesterol and high blood pressure. So there's about five different things that go into it, depending on the definition. And if you have three of those markers, it's deemed that you have metabolic syndrome. So it's a collection of factors that contribute to the increased risk of developing chronic disease.
Mm-hmm. Now, does this study lead to future studies that will answer more questions about soup?
We hope so. That's because all we can say from this is that people who do consume more soup have a lower body weight. So a great thing to do next would be to move this on to a kind of randomized control trial where we actually give people who are overweight and obese increased portions of soup to see if this can lead to a weight reduction.
I wonder if you know, and I notice from your accent you're not a native Iowan, but how do we compare in the United States with other countries as far as on the soup lovers scale? Are we, generally speaking, big soup lovers?
Not particularly. Other countries do tend to have a higher consumption of soup. I believe Japan is one country that has quite a high consumption of soup. Britain, I think I used to consume soup more when I lived there because I guess it was just damper and darker and soup seemed much more reasonable.
we can have those times here in Iowa, too. It's a little bit colder, though, I think.
That's right.
Now, I don't know, coming from Britain, are you a Seinfeld fan, a fan of the Soup Nazi?
I most certainly am, yes. Yes.
Okay, so your last question for today, and maybe it falls outside of your area of expertise, any idea why the Soup Nazi on Seinfeld makes us laugh so much?
That is beyond my level of expertise, but it just does every time I see it.
Okay, thank you very much for talking with us today about this new study. James Hollis, Assistant Professor of Food Science and Human Nutrition at Iowa State University, lead author of a paper published recently in the journal PLOS that tells us Americans who eat soup are less likely to be overweight. Thank you, James.
Thank you very much.
It's our final few minutes of a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and let's finish up with this piece. Caucus is a new film by filmmaker A.J. Schnock. It follows Republican presidential hopefuls during the 2011-2012 caucus season, from city park to coffee shop to house party by the pool. Here's a little taste of the film from its trailer.
I guess you can go back to June. This race has been about two candidates. The problem is, it hadn't been the same two candidates for any 2 months in a row.
We will beat Obama, and I'm here to tell you, it's not even going to be close this election. It's going to be close.
Perhaps you recognize those two voices, Rick Santorum, first of all, followed by Michelle Bachmann. Now, Iowa Public Radio's Dury Buscarin spoke with the director of this new film, Caucus, A.J. Schnock. He says in the months leading up to the 2012 Iowa caucuses, he learned about how Iowans respond to the influx of candidates.
They aren't blinded by the celebrity of politicians when they come to the state. They may be excited about meeting individuals, but they're more pressed with their task of trying to figure out if this person is ready to be a candidate for president. And to see them go into these meetings with a somewhat skeptical eye and with a tough question that isn't necessarily what the media is asking that day, that is a really amazing piece to the American political system.
Director of the new documentary film, A.J. Schnock, in conversation with IPR's Dury Buscarin today. Joining me to talk for just a few minutes about the film, Gazette columnist Jennifer Hemmingson. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. You wrote a recent column about this film. You've seen the film, right?
I have, yeah. I had a preview of it last week.
Mm-hmm. You point out in your column that you are no film reviewer, but you do, as we know, follow politics. You've seen the film. Give us a sense. We had a little bit of the trailer there, but give us a broader sense of the approach this film takes.
Yeah, I thought it was a great film. You know, it took a really sort of on-the-ground, broad view of the process, which, you know, is long, it's messy, it's involved. Especially last time around, there were tons of ups and downs. And, you know, we tend to follow it either by the polls or by the media that come in from the outside, but he really got up there close and not only at the events, but sort of what was going on beyond the events, and it's a good film.
Mm-hmm. And any parts you can describe that you especially liked in the film? What images, scenes, quotes stand out for you?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you probably remember when Newt Gingrich was here at the Carver College of Medicine, and he sort of shouted down by a group of protesters, and that was big news. What I loved was that Schnock then followed Gingrich outside of the event, and he does this on a number of occasions. You know, it reminds us of big sort of newsworthy events during the season, but then follows the candidates outside and shows us sort of how he was responding. You know, and Gingrich just sort of jokes to an aide. He says, you know, it was good practice, and then they head on to Des Moines. You know, so you see sort of the people behind the event, which is really what the Iowa caucuses are all about.
Right.
You know, speaking of mastication, right? We bring all the candidates in and we chew them up. So.
Now Rick Perry was a part of this one. There's an attack ad in this film on him, right?
Oh, I don't know if you remember that, but I saw that thing when I closed my eyes at night. Remember when he's standing in his duck coat, walking, talking about school, and
right.
He's in the military. Yeah, so that one makes an appearance. And Michelle Bachmann, when she was going through her chronically late period, and she would always show up to events half hour, 45 minutes late. So, yeah, if you want to just go and eat some popcorn and have a trip down memory lane, there's that for you, too.
Okay, I want to read some of the words from your column, because I love the way you sum it up in your column. Here's your writing. Caucus presents a three-dimensional look at everything lovable and questionable about our much-beloved, much-reviled event. It's worth seeing, and not just so you can listen to Herman Cain sing or see Marcus Bachman thumb wrestle people for votes.
Yep. two good moments in the film.
Okay. Caucus opens today in Des Moines, tomorrow in Iowa City, and at select theaters in Iowa on October 28th. Caucusfilm.com is the website to check out. And thank you very much, Jennifer Hemmingson, Gazette columnist, for sharing with us some of your thoughts.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Technical support from Dennis Reese, the executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, is Catherine Perkins. You know, I mentioned Monday, we have our sleep doctor here. I do wish you all the best sleep over the weekend. But in case you don't have a good night's sleep, won't you call in and tell us why? If it's unusual, it's better, the reason you're not getting sleep. Anyway, I'm not making much sense. Maybe I need sleep. It's good the weekend's coming up. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.